Hi, everyone. Peter here with a quick announcement. We're now on our 11th episode, well into the double digits. Thank you to everyone who has been faithfully listening to the show, and a special thanks to our members on Patreon. If you'd like to check out the extra blog posts and bonus episodes that are available on Patreon too for members, we would welcome your support. It doesn't take much. Every little bit helps and is greatly appreciated. Or, you know, you can also give a lot, as actors making a stage appeal often like to tell an audience with a twinkle in their eye. Please remember, no donation is too large. We want to especially thank Jim and Kate for their pledge of ongoing support on Patreon. And we are also grateful to Megan, who generously sent us a fascinating book about Philadelphia theater history, one which I've already started mining for details and ideas. Thank you. Thank you all. I am eternally grateful. If you, too, want to do something concrete and substantial, but don't have the cash to spare right now, here's what you can do right now. Leave a review of the show on a podcasting app. Whatever platform you're using, that is something really helpful that you can do for us, and it only costs you a minute of your time. Tell you what, you know, if you are listening to the show on your iMac computer or on your iPhone or any other Apple device, and you're using iTunes or Apple Podcasts, pause this show right now. You just press pause and go do that. Leave that review. Scroll down to the bottom of the list of episodes and give us some of those little stars. The empty stars there, fill some in. And type in some nice words if you can. All right, I'll wait for you to get back, okay? Press pause. There. Are you back? Okay, thanks. That was so nice of you. Now, we can continue. Here we go. Welcome and welcome again to Adventures in Theater History, Philadelphia. Over these past 10 episodes, I've been telling some of the stories of the first great high period of Philadelphia theater from 1793 to 1820, when the city really was at the center of the cultural life of the young American Republic in many respects. We left with the rather amazing story of how the skull of George Frederick Cook went briefly back on the stage after his death, and then ended up in Philadelphia on a shelf in a local medical college. I ought to mention, by the way, a recent communication I had this week from the delightfully named Michael Angelo, who is the archivist and the head of historic collections at Thomas Jefferson University's Scott Memorial Library. Mr. Angelo confirms to me that the item is not on public display, but here's an amazing prospect. He also informs me that he is making plans to have this skull scanned and possibly made available someday as a download to 3D printers so that any theater company producing Hamlet that wants to use a facsimile of the Cook skull in the role of Yorick can do so. Now, that would be pretty amazing. I will keep you updated if I hear more. Okay. Let's begin our story. As the year 1811 ended, and as the year 1812 began, there was one more odd legacy of George Frederick Cook to affect Philadelphia theater, if rather indirectly. We have the account, once again, from the historian Charles Durang, who has been an invaluable guide to us in every episode we have released so far. Charles Durang, you will remember, was the eldest son of the dancer and performer John Durang, who, along with most of the Durang family, was in the regular employment of the Chestnut Street Theater as dancers, singers, scene painters, whatever they needed. Charles was a young man, at this point, just starting out in his own theater career, and in November of 1811, he had taken a job with Alexander Placide, a Frenchman, who was then running a theater company that played in the southern United States. The Warren and Wood New Theater Company had a monopoly on the Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington market, and Placide was setting up a new circuit in Virginia, Georgia, and the Carolinas. Placide's newest venue, a theater in Richmond, Virginia, was being kept open for performances long past its usual end of the season because George Frederick Cook had promised him that he would perform there. Remember that Cook was in Philadelphia that November on his second visit to the city. Charles Durang had been hired to drive Cook down to Richmond in a carriage afterwards, but unfortunately, a dinner and drinking party was held at the Mansion House Hotel first to celebrate Cook's agreement with Placide, and as you might predict, it went badly awry. As Cook grew more intoxicated, his ill-tempered wit inevitably surfaced, and his animosity to foreigners increased. He declared that he would never go to Richmond unless Placide immediately sang the song, "God Save the King," with all the proper words. Placide, who, as a French-American, naturally did not really know the British anthem, made a Gaelic-inflected botch of the song and the words, and Cook was vitriolic. "Stop! You have insulted the feelings of George Frederick Cook, and by the great Jehovah, I won't go with you." And so the actor refused to honor his commitment to tour the South. Placide, like his fellow Frenchmen Pepin and Brichard in Philadelphia, as we learned last time, was now bereft of any prospect of bringing a star performer to his new theater. He and Charles Durang returned to Richmond themselves to close out the season with just the regular acting company. And matters were even further delayed when a member of that acting company, a leading lady named Eliza Poe, suddenly died. And after a suitable period of mourning for her, Placide felt that he still owed his audience in Richmond that final show. So instead of the previously promised George Frederick Cook in Richard III, he scheduled a farewell benefit performance of a holiday pantomime for families with children the day after Christmas, December 26th, 1811. During that show, however, a horrible disaster would occur. A candle flame that was part of a set piece came in contact with a curtain during a scene change. An actor quickly shouted that there was a fire on the stage, but some of the audience thought this was part of the show, and they were soon to learn the awful truth when the terrified stagehands cut the ropes to the curtain backstage and the blazing scenery dropped to the floor. Smoke and gas billowed up to the top of the theater, smothering everyone in the upper galleries to death immediately. And as the rafters of the theater had unwisely been constructed of recently cut pine logs, quickly the whole roof of the building was ablaze and searing hot pitch was dripping down onto the stage and into the house. Actors jumped out of dressing room windows, the audience ran for the exits, but the corridors were jammed and people were trampling each other and only so many could make it out in time. 72 people were killed, officially, including the sitting governor of Virginia. 54 of these victims were women, and most of them were burned beyond recognition. And some say that the audience members in the segregated upper gallery, who died first, all of whom were African American, were never fully accounted for. It was a scene that only Eliza Poe's son, Edgar Allan, could perhaps adequately someday describe in writing. That same week, the converted Philadelphia Circus on 9th and Walnut was ready to open for the first time ever with a proscenium stage as the Olympic Theater on New Year's Day, 1812. They were opening with Richard Brinsley Sheridan's play, The Rivals. The newspaper ads were already prepared and were being printed on December 31st. And unfortunately, of course, therefore, these ran right alongside the accounts of the Richmond fire from a few days before. Here's the words of one such ad, quote, the managers of the Olympic Theatre, Messrs. Pepin, Brechard, and Beaumont, have the satisfaction of announcing to the public that the above theatre, being at an enormous expense prepared for dramatic representation, will be opened on Wednesday evening, January 1st, 1812. Pepin and Brechard's long-awaited expansion was finally ready, and their circus-slash-theatre could now start to bring them the revenue that they had borrowed so much money for, and that they had so long hungered for, and in addition to Sheridan's popular comedy, there would be more feats of horsemanship, and then after that, a comedy called The Poor Soldier. Meanwhile, the managers Warren and Wood, over at the new theater on Chestnut Street, were not taking this new challenge to their primacy in the Philadelphia theatrical market lying down. On New Year's Day 1812, said their own advertisements in the newspapers, they had scheduled, quote, the first night in America of the celebrated dramatic romance, The Lady of the Lake, by John Edmund Eyre, based on the poem by Sir Walter Scott, with entirely new scenery, dresses, and decoration. Of course, those of you listening may not be familiar with this play, The Lady of the Lake, anymore, and that unlike The Rivals, that tried-and-true warhorse of a comedy that the Olympic was trotting out, this was quite a fashionable and recent London hit. But you know, in fact, hey, I think you probably do know a tune from the show. Hail to the chief who in triumph advances, honored and blessed be the evergreen pine. Well, I won't sing anymore. Not because I don't like singing, I do, but because, in fact, like the rest of you, I only know the melody to the first two lines, and I had to look up the lyrics after those first four words. Hail to the chief. Anyway, by all accounts, it was quite a spectacular show. And for the rest of the month of January 1812, the battle to attract the biggest audience continued between the two theater companies. Yet throughout all this month, the stories continued to appear in all the Philadelphia newspapers about the rising death toll and the horrible stories from down in Virginia. The Olympic would advertise a lighthearted play called Laugh While You Can, and then right near it on the same page would be a heavy black headline saying, Deplorable Conflagration at Richmond Theater. And every Sunday, by the way, Protestant ministers were delivering sermons to their congregations that the Richmond fire was, of course, a divine judgment upon the immorality of the theater itself. Well, actually, the Olympic Theater was not doing too badly in terms of the box office. That first performance of The Rivals brought in $1,400. Perhaps their natural crowds were not the newspaper reading or church-going type, but the vivid melodramas, the popular plays, and the patriotic equestrian spectacles that Pepin and Brechard were offering seemed to have their appeal all through that winter season. Or perhaps they were just stealing the new theater's audience, as their managers, so used to the longtime monopoly in Philadelphia theater, had always feared. A February production at the Olympic of Shakespeare's play, A Winter's Tale, a difficult text that the new theater had never attempted, just got good box office on Walnut Street due to the addition of the extravagant costumes and the sets by the architect William Strickland and, of course, the horses, which they put into the scenes at King Leontes' court. Over on Chestnut Street, Warren and Wood looked gloomily at the prospects for the rest of their season. A downturn was continuing to depress the local economy, war seemed to be looming with Great Britain, and the circus was taking their audience, and now the newspapers would not stop printing the words theater and fire. Quote, this awful event would alone have arrested for a season a current of the best fortune, sighed William Wood in his memoir. It seemed to create a perfect panic, which deterred the largest portion of the audience for a long time from venturing into a crowd, either theatrical or other. For many weeks thereafter, Warren and Wood at the new theater would have to regularly reassure their patrons from the stage before the show that they had firefighters positioned in the house, and in fact an entire volunteer fire company had taken residence directly next door. here's the thing that was really bugging Warren and Wood. All the actors now performing at the Olympic Theater, those were their former employees. The new theater was having trouble retaining its lower and mid-level performers. One of their reliable actors of several years, a Scotsman named Donald McKenzie, had openly rebelled against them, defecting to the Olympic Theater, breaking his contract with them, and encouraging his fellow Scotsmen in the city to riot and demonstrate during William Wood's performances in the fall of 1811. Now it was even worse. All the performers acting in The Rivals on Walnut Street, Mr. Tyler, Mr. McKenzie, Mr. Dwyer, Mr. and Mrs. Wilmot, Mrs. Bray, they had formerly been part of the company at the Chestnut, but realizing that they could not seem to advance into larger roles there, had decamped to the Olympic on Walnut. Even Charlotte Melmoth, a highly experienced actress who had performed for many years in both Philadelphia and New York, was portraying Mrs. Malaprop in The Rivals. Oh, it gave them the hydrostatics to such a degree. Warren and Wood could not understand exactly what was going on, but they had their suspicions. First, it was the local theater critics whom they thought tended to praise lesser performers in the company unduly, just to make a fetish out of their superior and specialized tastes in the dramatic arts. And this, of course, gave some actors ideas beyond their station. And Mr. Carpenter, at the Mirror of Taste, oh, he was the worst of these, they thought. Although he had praised George Frederick Cook to the skies, he had taken a violent dislike to the theater's star comedian, Joseph Jefferson, and kept suggesting instead that other bit players could do his roles better. It was most impertinent. What the new theater was finally seeing was the result of a long-building resentment on the part of the rest of its stock company, those actors who were usually never or rarely assigned any leading roles, which usually went to Warren, to Wood, to Mrs. Wood, and to Jefferson, and to Mrs. Jefferson. Or even worse, those parts would go to any barnstorming English or New York star, like Cook or Thomas Cooper. If you had been pegged as someone who was willing to accept small roles, well, then that was what you did. From then on, you would never get to take center stage yourself, explained Charles Durang, who, remember, was an actor at times in the company, and although he had no pretensions to being a great actor himself, he had a very watchful eye, even as a young man, on the doings of his erstwhile employers. Quote, the Chestnut Street Theater was an excellent school for novices in those days, but a sad place for the young aspirant's ambitious views. There seemed an insuperable bar to promotion in that ancien regime to the minor performer. Once a captain, always a captain. Once a private, always a private. That was the maxim of the old Chestnut Street cabinet. These fogey ideas bred great discontent amongst the secondary people. Close quotes. Furthermore, thought Durang, there was a decided bias against native-born American actors like him. Quote, the notion of an American having talent was then deemed eminently utopian. Some of us wild young Americans would venture to indulge in prophetic speculation as to the future of the drama, but we were only laughed at or sneered at. How men like Warren, Wood, and Jefferson, who came hither from England with good sense of observation and education, having their own children born here, could indulge in such fantasies, I never could understand, but such is the mystery of national prejudice. Close quotes. Durang also archly noted that those prejudices tended to disappear when those children, the young Warrens, the young Woods and Jeffersons, all American-born now, grew up and entered into the theater profession themselves, as they did. By the summer of 1812, the public horror over the Richmond fire had faded, but of course there was now the prospect of war, the War of 1812, which was declared that July. theater attendance all over the country dropped precipitously. Pepin and Brichard's fortunes never recovered from this blow. They broke up their circus company into smaller units, and they tried to tour, but they found it rough going. And along with Alexander Placide, they opened up a theater in New York, also called the Olympic, and they moved the company there, but that faltered when Mrs. Melmoth broke her arm in a carriage accident. And then the unfortunate Placide himself got sick and died of pneumonia. Their renovated Philadelphia theater was mostly dark and unused in the summer and fall of 1812. We noted back in episode 7 that on September 3rd, it was quite easily rented for a one-time dance performance by a group of traveling Native Americans. By October 15th, Brichard and Pepin closed their theater totally, and in February 1813, it was seized by their creditors, and it was sold at an auction, or was offered to be sold. There were no buyers, so their principal creditor, a flower merchant named James Clempson, took control of it and rented it out to the occasional rope dancer or acrobatic troupe or circus, and the two Frenchmen continued to perform there sporadically. But by December 1813, they had given their last show together at the Olympic. They broke up their circus company, and the two men set out separately into the western and southern states. In 1813 and 1814, therefore, even though the war between Britain and America continued to rage, well past its eponymous year, theater in Philadelphia was in a sad state. Once again, despite its largely British management and mindset, the new theater did its best, staging many popular patriotic tributes to American heroes who had scored victories over the British Navy, though it stayed mostly quiet about the defeats. True, some of its American members, like Charles Durang and his brother Ferdinand, enlisted in the American Army for a period, and some of the British actors found it a convenient time to leave America entirely during the hostilities. A large portion of the new theater's costumes and sets from its Baltimore house was even burned in a Maryland warehouse by the marauding British Admiral Cochrane in 1814. William Warren blamed the politicians for getting the country into war in the first place.
"All of this might have been avoided had wisdom and not passion prevailed in the councils of the nation," he complained in his diary.
The rebellion by his discontented actors had continued during this time of war, and in 1813 these rebels had formed a company of their own, led by one William Thwaites, also another disgruntled employee. Tired of the petty fines, the favoritism in casting and the star system, the profiteering of the management in both New York and Philadelphia theaters, these actors called themselves the Theatrical Commonwealth, pledging to share the proceeds of any box office equitably amongst all the members of the company. I mean, it's not like they were proto-socialists or anything like that. To their minds, they were merely trying to reinstate the old sharing system that many groups of European actors, including Shakespeare's, had operated under during the 16th and 17th centuries. It was, in fact, the system that the Hallam Company had used when it first toured America in the middle of the 18th century. But as theater companies had begun to settle down into American cities on a more permanent basis, that earlier economic model, that sharing system, had been abandoned, both in England and in America, as more highly capitalized managers organized their stock companies on a weekly salary/annual benefit model. Forfeits or fines could be imposed by management if an actor misbehaved in the green room or was even late for an entrance, and disparities in income between the upper and lower classes of actors, as it were, began to widen. Now, I'd like to talk about the Theatrical Commonwealth Company for a minute more, because it's usually given short shrift in the history books as being a group of hopeless dreamers or pitiful malcontents. They were led, as I said, by the actor William Thwaites, who, along with his wife, had once been a regular company member on Chestnut Street, and he attempted to rally public opinion to their side on the grounds of democratic and egalitarian principles. You know, not just actors, but in fact, scene painters and musicians from the new theater had joined them. And they were renting the old theater, the Southwark Theater on South Street, by this point, a long-serving venue for all marginal and striving entertainers in the city. And they published in the newspaper an appeal that Thwaites had written. But in the early 19th century, such an organization quickly faltered on the rocks of complete public indifference. It turned out that no one actually cared about how a theater company was paid and organized. The Theatrical Commonwealth played in New York City for a few months, then they returned to Philadelphia, and they actually took over the vacant Olympic Theater on Walnut Street in early 1814, offering to the public such novel but rather obscure plays as The Honeymoon, Rugatino, Bravo of Venice, and The Students of Salamanca. But just like those titles, the company soon sank into oblivion, and their brave leader, William Thwaites, succumbed to the chronic asthma which plagued him, and he died later that year in New York. But the idea of a theatrical commonwealth has a certain appeal, even today. After all, why exactly does every entertainment organization and sports team have to have owners and producers? Shouldn't arts workers not be alienated from access to the means of their productions, to coin a phrase? Or perhaps American theater, instead of hewing to the British economic model, could have been organized in a way that didn't involve years of obscure labor for so many, resulting in only a pauper's grave. William Wood, in his memoirs, harrumphed that if only actors would be individually responsible, they could certainly prosper and die rich. Wood literally spends pages in his memoir listing off the names of actors who carefully saved and invested and left their families comfortably provided for. Now, those actors who died poor or who left the business or who have never advanced or died young, well, that was sad, wasn't it? They shouldn't have been so foolish as to not be chosen as leading performers or been profligate in their ways. It didn't seem to occur to him that there was any other way of doing things. To him, virtue and talent were always rewarded, and he felt that if people were careful and judicious and good with numbers like him, they'd do okay. Now, the playwright and author William Dunlap, on the other hand, wrote a book in 1832 called A History of the American Theater. He had literally been watching American drama develop since 1776, so he had some standing, and after 60 years, he wondered if there wasn't another way. His takeaway from the story of the theatrical commonwealth was not that it was misguided, but that it was impossible, seeing how British and American society failed to adequately support the majority of theater artists, both financially and spiritually. If profits were the ultimate goal, then art would suffer, he felt. An entire chapter of his history is devoted to advocating for government or community-supported model of the theater, as was then being done in France and many principalities of Germany. Wrote Dunlap, quote, "The expenses of theater, governed by the state or by an enlightened and patriotic association, would be defrayed by the visitors, but profit should not be the object. Loss should not be feared. Men of learning and belles-lettres scholars would be the directors and writers. They would be made independent. Actors who are artists and scholars would be the performers and equally made independent. Every abuse would vanish. The theater would be a temple of the muses, the graces, and the virtues." Close quotes. That's very Platonic of Dunlap, a theater of philosopher king, so to speak. And we all know now, of course, that in America there would never be a real public commitment to supporting the performing arts. Market forces prevail in this country at both the popular and the elite level, even in the so-called non-profit theaters of today. But it's interesting to note that other people noticed this problem right at the very beginning of things. This is not a new conversation. And those who wish to argue for the profit motive as a driver of innovation and excitement in the theater, well, you're about to get your justification, too. It's too bad the Theatrical Commonwealth Company no longer had access to equestrian entertainments, and it's too bad for Pepin and Brichard that their historical timing was so off, as it were, because as soon as the Napoleonic Wars in Europe ended in 1815, transatlantic ship traffic was free of all the marauding privateers, and things took off again. By 1816, another circus company was coming across the Atlantic on its way to Philadelphia, and this time the circus was English, and it was headed by James West. West's company, like John Bill Ricketts before him, had only been a minor figure in Britain, and he was striking out to America to make his fortune. He was expert in all the current fashions in the London entertainment world, where increasingly performing animals were being brought directly onto the stage. In fact, he was bringing with him the newest sensation from the London theater scene, hippodrama. Hippodrama does not mean plays with hippos. Hippopotamuses are notoriously hard to manage on stage. After all, they never hit their marks. They simply won't take direction. Now, in this case, hippo, of course, is Greek for horse. In Europe, melodramas, which used horses on stage, were filling houses everywhere. And it was a time when classical written drama was otherwise a bit moribund and not actually very well attended. Even Covent Garden and Drury Lane had found it expedient to add horses to such shows as Bluebeard, and to begin to stage equestrian melodramas like this classic, Timur the Tartar. When West arrived in Philadelphia, he booked the vacant Olympic Theater in the autumn of 1816 as the natural place to exhibit his company's talents, which included also a Mr. Campbell, an extremely talented clown. Timur the Tartar had already been staged by Pepin and Brichard Circus at the Olympic, but the general wartime nervousness had kept the audience's interest low. West's new production, along with his exhibitions of grand military horsemanship and drill, was evidently even grander and even more elaborately staged than Pepin and Brichard's. And in peacetime, illusions of battlefields and waterfalls and ocean cliffs were very appealing to Philadelphia audiences. Timur the Tartar, by the way, is set in medieval Poland during the time of the Mongol invasions. The plot, like that of many melodramas, is very complex and very exciting. It involves stories of thwarted young lovers and warfare and rescues and near-death experiences, and it would take much too long for me to detail it all here. At the climactic moment of the show, the heroine, Zorilda, on horseback, jumps into the sea to escape her captors. And then the hero, Agib, on horseback, plunges in the sea after her. And the two lovers arise from the water on the back of the horse. And this infallibly brought an ecstatic reaction from the people in the audience. Charles Durang, once again, provides a great description of the scene at the Olympic Theater. Quote, "The horses were taught to imitate the agonies of death, and they did so in a manner which was astonishing. In the last scene, when Zorilda, mounted on her splendid white charger, ran up the stupendous cataract to the very height of the stage, the feat really astounded the audience. Perhaps no event in our theatrical annals ever produced so intense an excitement as that last scene. The people in the pit and boxes arose with a simultaneous impulse to their feet and with canes, hands, and wild screams kept the house in one uproar of shouts for at least 5 minutes. The next day, the success of the piece was the general topic of conversation." Close quote. Night after night, West's equestrian company packed the Olympic Theater. Campbell's benefit night alone earned $1,700. Over on Chestnut Street, well, the houses were sparse in comparison, and manager William Wood was in agonies. We even have a torn scrap of paper from him on which he desperately scribbled down comparative box office figures between the two houses. He figured that the Olympic had grossed over $21,000 in 27 performances, while his own house only averaged $569 a night. And it wasn't simply a matter that the Chestnut Street Company was offering highbrow material while the equestrian circus was giving popular fare meant to appeal to broader tastes. Indeed, noted Wood, it was his high-end audiences in the boxes that deserted and went off to see Zerilda being rescued from the waves. West went back to England with all the money he had ever hoped to have and, in fact, was able to retire at a young age. Once he was gone, in the following seasons, Warren and Wood had learned their lesson. They realized they needed to follow the dictates of the audience, and they began scheduling more operas, more spectacles, and more melodramas. They invested money in their infrastructure, modernizing the theater by adding a gas heating system to warm up the house in the winters for the first time. And also, for the first time in any American theater, they had gas lights illuminating the stage at night. And to appeal to local audiences, they changed the name of the company from the New Theater. We've been calling it the New Theater for 9 episodes now, but they changed it from the New Theater to the Philadelphia Theater. And they began to bring horses onto the stage, too. Their annual production of Bluebeard, or Female Curiosity, we talked about a few episodes ago, that now included a pair of learned elephants. Learned elephants. I would have paid to see that, too, I suppose. But nobody, even the discontented actors of their troupe, attempted to repeat the efforts of the now disbanded theatrical commonwealth. It was a noble experiment, but really, it won't entice that many people to come inside a theater with a plea for economic equality and social justice. That might be a tactic for a political meeting, but it's not a great tactic for filling seats of a theater. You gotta promise the folks a great show, or put horses and elephants on the stage, or you give your audience door prizes, or, I don't know, ice cream. Ice cream, in fact, is exactly what some other new entrants into Philadelphia theater and popular entertainment were offering. During this period, in both New York and Philadelphia, businesses calling themselves pleasure gardens were opening up on the edges of the cities where the buildings gave way to the open countryside. In a time before there were public parks, these privately owned pleasure gardens were large landscaped green spaces where in the evenings and weekends the urban populations could escape the close confines of the tightly packed business districts. Now, once again, in this respect, they were following London fashions and often even named the pleasure gardens Vauxhall, after the great pleasure garden that was then on the banks of the Thames River. In Philadelphia, these spaces were not along the riverbanks, but inland to the west and north of the built-up area. They were usually surrounded by a high fence, and like a theater, you had to pay at the gate to get in. But once inside, you could enjoy the lawns, the shrubbery, the shaded walks, the hanging lanterns, the fountains, the cool drinks, and the entertainment. One of the first to open was the Columbian Gardens, which opened in 1813 on the north side of 13th and Market Street, next to the center square where City Hall now sits. Owned and operated by Lawrence Astolfi, a confectioner and a distiller, once you got inside it, you'd find an open stage surrounded by terraces and tables and chairs, and he offered the public fireworks and evenings of songs and performing acrobats and light dramatic entertainments and patriotic illuminated transparencies. And, of course, there was strawberry ice cream for sale. Ice cream, formerly only a delicacy in the houses of rich people, was now becoming a mass-produced treat and would have been a great drawing point for the family crowd on a summer evening, perhaps even more than the performers. By 1820, the Columbian Gardens had been renamed the Tivoli Gardens, and it even had an indoor winter counterpart, a theater on Prune Street to the east of Washington Square. By the way, on the blog of the podcast's website, aithpodcast.com, you can see a map of Philadelphia that I've borrowed and adapted from an article on Philadelphia's Pleasure Gardens by the scholar Anne Beamish. This map shows the locations of all Philadelphia's theaters and pleasure gardens in the early decades of the 19th century. Check it out. The Columbian Gardens' biggest competition was the Quaker City's version of the Vauxhall Gardens on the northeast corner of Walnut and Broad Street, right where the huge Wells Fargo Bank building is today. Its first manager was also Italian, a perfumer and a hairdresser called Giovanni Scotti. Signor Scotti had labored long and hard for over a year at creating a beautiful space for Philadelphians to enjoy, and when it finally opened in 1815, it was widely hailed as a quite fashionable and an agreeable resort. In addition to its green spaces and trees hung with thousands of lanterns in the evenings, it had a huge and elegant pavilion with a dome and an open-air theater in which were held balls and concerts and public dances. In 1818, Scotti sold the business to one Charles Magner, who poured even more money into staging grand entertainments, and some of the former members of the theatrical commonwealth, in fact, such as John Dwyer, now found gainful employment as a singer and comic monologuist, delivering the familiar variety show act called a lecture on heads. For a particular sensation, such contraptions as velocipedes, an early version of the bicycle, would be exhibited, and professional balloonists would inflate their crafts on the Vauxhall Garden grounds and then sail off into the sky. Now, crowds on such occasions were often immense, and on one particular occasion, I'm sorry to say, things got very out of control. On September 8th, 1819, an aerostatic exhibition was offered at the Vauxhall Gardens, starring a French balloonist named Michel. Monsieur Michel, it was stated, would inflate and ride in his hot air balloon above the city and then jump out with a parachute and descend to earth again. To get inside the fenced area of Vauxhall Gardens and listen to an orchestra concert while watching the initial proceedings of the balloon's inflation, you had to pay a dollar. And about 600 people did that. Thousands of other people, of course, who would rather watch the show for free, gathered outside the fence in the middle of what was then the mostly vacant and unused expanse of Broad Street. Inside, employees would poke and shove away any of the non-paying crowd who got too near the fence, and they, in turn, were met with showers of stones by the indignant crowd. It didn't like being shoved. It is likely that one of the stones that they threw pierced the balloon as it was filling up, and the hot air began escaping. The balloon sagged alarmingly, and after several hours, it looked as if it really would never get off the ground, much to everyone's annoyance. And one young boy tried to get a little higher to take a better look, and he shimmied up a tree near the fence, and to get him down from seeing the show without paying, this miscreant was prodded with sticks by the garden staff, and the boy fell heavily to the ground. Word spread quickly to the crowd that the boy was dead, and indignant feelings rose to a fever pitch. The crowd, in fact, became a mob. The fence surrounding the garden was ripped down, and thousands of people poured into the park. As patrons and musicians scattered, this mob tore up the balloon. It tore up the parachute, and it tore up everything else they could get their hands on. The bar was raided, and all the liquor distributed and quickly consumed, and all the hanging lanterns were torn down, and somebody applied one of the flames to the pavilion, and soon everything was ablaze. Rioters were running amok, and the entire pavilion and theater of Vauxhall Gardens was on fire and quickly consumed. As a portent of things to come in Philadelphia, this riot and fire was an ominous sign. As we shall see in our next episode, these rising urban tensions were causing all sorts of moral panics among the white middle and upper classes in Philadelphia. And then there was the downturn in the economy again. Without the presence of more traveling circuses, an attempt by some to set up another acting company at the Olympic Theater went totally bankrupt, and in 1818 it was bought out by a consortium of 115 local merchants and bankers. For the first time ever, legal documents that we can see refer to the building specifically as the Walnut Street Theater. Meanwhile, attendance at the renamed Philadelphia Theater on Chestnut Street dipped noticeably in the 1819-1820 season. Even their innovation of gas lights and having more stars and more novelties and more melodramas failed to attract crowds. The average house brought in less than $400. The lesser members of the company noted with sour satisfaction that William Warren, one of the two bosses, had such a poor payout from his particular benefit night that he was forced to hold a second one. But he only got an additional $274. Warren and Wood decided to close the Philadelphia Theater somewhat early that season on account of the poor houses. And on March 27, 1820, they ended their run with a performance of a comedy entitled The Soldier's Daughter. Warren and Wood, as usual, assigned themselves the two leading roles, and Joseph Jefferson and his wife were also given large parts. And after a musical interlude in which the Echo Song was performed by a Miss Burke, the New York star Henry Wallack appeared in a melodrama called The Ruffian Boy. After the final curtain, the company left and traveled to Baltimore the next day, hoping to find better fortune. On the morning of April 3rd, William Wood was awakened in his hotel by a knock on his bedroom door. It was the company prop manager with a solemn face and a packet of letters. He handed them gravely to Wood. On the outside of the top envelope was a scribbled note from Richard Bache, the son-in-law of Benjamin Franklin, who was then the postmaster of Philadelphia. "Dear Wood, this letter bears sad news for you. Early last evening, your beautiful theater was wholly consumed by fire." The Premier Theater of America, which had stood on 6th and Chestnut Street since 1793, was no more. What had happened? Tune in next time, when we explore the circumstances of that unfortunate theater fire and many other theater fires that were to occur in Philadelphia over the next few decades. It's quite a story. I'm Peter Schmitz, and the sound and the music are by Christopher Mark Colucci. Thanks for coming along on another adventure in theater history, Philadelphia.